All right, on today's podcast, we have Michael Fritzell. He is the author, publisher, writer, handyman at Asian Century Stocks, which you can find at asiancenturystocks.com. Michael, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for coming on here. You are definitely one of my favorite follows on Twitter. And it is because I know nothing about Asian equities or Asian markets or anything like that. And so I'm able to learn from you. So right off the top here, let's give the audience, you know, what is Asian Century Stocks and how did you get into starting it?
Sure. Okay. So Asian Century Stocks is a Substack or a blog with paid subscribers. And I provide them with basically investment ideas. But I also talk about broad trends in Asia and basically themes that I think that they could kind of ride or that they can benefit from as investors. So typically, every 2 weeks, I would release a deep dive, an idea, investment idea. And I would also provide them with my own portfolio and show them how I invest myself. So I invest across these Asian markets, and those include basically East Asia and Southeast Asia. I'm personally based in Singapore, where I've been for eight years roughly. But I'm originally from Sweden in Scandinavia, and I guess I can go back a little bit further. But I'm basically Swedish from the beginning, and after university in 2006, I started working in the UK, and after a few years of corporate finance experience in London, I moved to Asia in 2009. I lived in China for 4 years, where I worked for a emerging market fund. And after that, I moved to Singapore in 2014, working for a family office, as well as a few different funds. And since April then, this year, I've been focused fully on the Substack. So I invest family money while I also write full-time, basically, this Substack.
Nice. So were you on the research side or the sales and trading side at the firms you were at before?
So my first job out of university was in corporate finance, and I was in M&A most of the time, working for the transport team within a large bank in the UK. And since 2010, roughly, I've been on the buy side as a buy side research analyst. So I've always been I've also taken up co-portfolio manager roles, so part ownership of a portfolio, or rather, you know, investing a part of a larger portfolio. But really, most of my time has been doing pretty deep research. So my job has been to work for these funds, and I have not been public. All the research that I've done before has been internal research, basically supporting portfolio managers with their decisions. And I would meet management teams. I would meet competitors' management teams. Sometimes even speaking to clients or suppliers, to figure out to triangulate what this company is doing, what they're doing well and what they're not doing well, and so on. And then do financial modeling, try to figure out what a company is worth, and then make recommendations. So this last transition to Substack is really a big change for me, because before I've always been, pretty mum about what I've been doing for these funds, whereas now I'm completely public and I'm also, on Twitter and so on. So
when you left China, was that more of a decision to get out of China? Specifically, like as someone who was a foreigner there, given kind of like the, situation with, they're kind of like clamped down on civil liberties and stuff like that. Did that play into it at all? Or was it more so due to the fact that you just saw opportunity elsewhere in Singapore?
I think I actually saw the writing on the wall. 2013, when I left, that was early on in China's current transition to a new kind of political model. And already at that time, I think the freedoms were starting to disappear a little bit. There was a large conflict between China and Japan around the Diaoyu Islands, or Senkaku Islands, as they call it in Japan. And it became, I noticed, nationalism really taking, rearing its ugly head, as well as also there were new laws coming with, greater monitoring. Of course, the internet was already, censored to a large extent. But I remember some law stating that mobile phone manufacturers had to include special hardware for every phone sold in China, enabling better monitoring and so on. So it was clear already at that time that there was new leadership in Beijing, and that that made me a little bit worried. But there were other reasons as well. I just managed to find a job basically in Singapore that was really high, good pay and so on. So that was part of the attraction.
I mean, yeah, that's I think that you probably hit the nail on the head there of getting out when you did, which is not to say anything. I mean, I didn't even know about that hardware piece in the mobile phones. That's pretty scary.
I think it was a proposed. I'm talking from memory now, but I think it was a proposed law, some kind of suggestion that never made it into law. But in any case, China has changed a lot. And I think a lot of foreigners have already left now. A lot of these experts, such as Bill Bishop and many others, have already left.
I didn't realize Bill Bishop left. Someone who writes on explicitly on China, that's a little bit disheartening.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that if you're writing on some very sensitive subjects, it's time to become a lot more careful. Just a few weeks ago, maybe it was a few months ago, Beijing basically suggested to ban private participation in the media industry. It's going to be a lot more difficult to be a private company in China and release basically news or comment on news even. So eventually, a lot more of these news organizations will be state-owned. And just a few days ago, you also saw South China Morning Post in Hong Kong getting a bid from a state-owned company in China. So the walls are kind of narrowing for in terms of what you're able to say. And so far, it seems like blogs within China are still they're still allowed to operate. But I'm not sure. I mean, if you read the law strictly, it doesn't seem to be completely free anymore in terms of what you're able to write or not.
What is your media diet consist of, specifically in terms of an east-west divide?
I personally love Nikkei Asia. It's a fantastic newspaper. And I find that their reporting is very objective, like surprisingly so. So that's my number one, news source in terms of reading news.
And that's like the Wall Street Journal of Asia, right?
It is. The print version of Nikkei Asia only comes out one times per week. But I can really recommend it because you're getting a perspective that's really high quality, I would say, much better quality than what you get in the Wall Street Journal or New York Times. And it's not really colored as well. South China Morning Post is already a little bit more, there's a certain tilt there, certain leaning towards,
sure.
They wouldn't write too critical an article about the Chinese leadership, for example. Straits Times is basically a state-owned newspaper. And then you have some regional newspapers like Bangkok Post, which are okay. But Nikkei Asia is by far my favorite. And in terms of my diet, otherwise, I read a lot of Substacks. There are increasingly good ones out there. There are a few Southeast Asian ones. Asia Sentinel is one. This one whose name I can hardly pronounce, but dariemulut.substack.com. A lot of good ones, actually.
I asked. Yeah, I asked the question because I think that you're in a unique position to be able to parse out the wheat from the chaff in terms of what the perhaps more CCP aligned media or within their sphere of influence is saying, and then what the American or Western media is saying, and then finding kind of like the daylight between those two. Not to say that some of the American media isn't influenced that way as well, but that's kind of what's interesting to me, because I don't read anything that, you know, from Asia basically, besides when you put out posts, but that's, you know, have you found anything where you're like, oh, okay, there's kind of this delta between how these specific issues are being covered, and then, you know, how to ascertain truth from that?
I think that you also have that issue in the United States, that everything has become so polarized. And to be honest, it's exactly the same in Asia. Within Singapore, people I speak to tend to belong to either camp. They're either very much against the government, and typically also very much pro the communist Chinese government. There tends to be such a divide, even here in Asia. And newspapers, you know, they would be leaning one way or another. So in Singapore, there's one called Zaobao, which is a little bit more, you know, in one direction, and then the state media will be another direction. So I think you need to get different viewpoints, perhaps. And I think you're right. I mean, I am probably in a good position, better position than people sitting in China, because they just can't speak freely. Like, that is just a reality. It's like, so you cannot trust an analyst sitting in China, I believe, or if they're working for a Beijing news organization, you just cannot trust what they say. They don't have, you know, the ability to speak freely. So I'm very positive about Substack, because relying on subscriptions enables you to say exactly what you want so far, unless you're sitting in China and, you know, Chinese laws apply to you.
Now, the analysts in China that can't say exactly what they want, I assume, because it's such a big country, you know, this, it's more or less implied, right? Like, they know what they can't say. Is that more so? And then what happens is, if you say something you're not allowed to say, someone comes and alerts you of that fact in a myriad of ways.
You know, I would guess so. Exactly how it works, I'm not sure. But you can just look at what some of these analysts say. There's absolutely nothing critical, or they don't touch on politics. That is for sure. So if you, for example, if you analyze the Evergrande situation, no one talks about it from a political perspective, you know, outside of Japan or United States. No one does that. And it's just so fascinating, because, I mean, from my perspective, it's obviously something to do with, you know, intra-party politics. But, you know, in terms of the reporting in news media, there's no such mention. It's talked about as a crisis, as some kind of, you know, debt problem, which is true. But typically, banks have always supported Evergrande until now.
Didn't the CCP institute specific leverage caps, basically, like you could only be levered a certain amount, a certain ratio, and that's why they artificially had to basically like sell down their debt, I believe.
That's true. I mean, that is true. And roughly about half of these companies, they didn't meet those standards. And what was supposed to happen was, if you didn't meet those three red lines in terms of debt requirements, you could not grow your debt. You would have to deleverage slowly.
Oh, right. And these guys were basically playing a game of musical chairs where they were just borrowing against. Yeah, go ahead. Tell the story.
So, you know, with these three red lines in terms of debt requirements, they had to meet these requirements over a 3-year period. And they would have been fine. I mean, they just had to deleverage. But it was a very slow process, and they would have been able to do it. But there are signs, of course, that that banks cut off support much, much quicker than, you know, than what. And what we see happening now is that state-owned banks, or rather certain banks, will be able to use debt for M&A. Most likely, these assets will be purchased by state-owned enterprises at low prices. And you know, at the same time, we know that another competing faction within the party is a major shareholder of Evergrande. I mean, of course, I mean, I'm just speculating, but at least no one has really talked about it that way, except for this this author, Desmond Shum, in his book, Red Roulette. He talked about how Evergrande had used connections with prior premiers within the Chinese leadership and basically used those contacts to get land cheaply. And that's basically how they grew so quickly.
Is Red Roulette, is that a new book?
Yeah, it's a new book. It came out maybe about 1 month ago, like 6 weeks ago or so.
Okay, yeah, that sounds interesting. Well, you know, for it's also a little wild to me how quickly the story disappeared in the Western media. You know, there was 1 week where it dominated the headlines, and it was supposed to be the next Lehman. It was going to be 10 times bigger than Lehman, and maybe that'll happen, and it's just down the road or something. But it was a little bit crazy to me how quickly that story disappeared. I don't know that it was nefarious or anything, but it just certainly went from a total volcano to, you know, sunny skies almost immediately.
Exactly. I mean, what is driving this kind of effect? It's quite fascinating. I do know that some media, you know, some media outlets, they just want to collect clicks, and perhaps by focusing on the story intensely, perhaps that's a way to gain clicks in the short term. But somehow it just disappeared. And I've been following Evergrande for so many years now, and these issues have been, you know, obvious for so many years. In fact, I've been shorting the stock myself. But the reason it dropped, you know, right now is not because of, you know, a large, like a sudden crash in the house market, although that's also, there's been some weakness recently. But I mean, this debt problem has been building for so long, and they've had the support from banks until now. It's really, I think, you know, a lot of what we're seeing right now has to do with the National Congress 2022. So that's when the Xi Jinping is seeking a third term. He came, you know, he became president and general secretary in 2012. And typically those terms will be five years, and they will stay on for two terms, 10 years. But next year, he is likely to seek, you know, a third term, and potentially even longer. You know, he might stay on until 2035. And I think there's a lot of political opposition within the party. I mean, there's opposition against him. They don't want him to stay on as a president. So we'll see whether he will succeed. But a lot of what we're seeing right now is basically a power game within the party. But there's also, you know, certain interest groups within the economy, within the private sector, that are kind of against him. So these are ways of controlling your enemies. So we know that for sure. Like, certain private companies are tightly connected with prior premiers or presidents, like Alibaba, for example.
Right. Well, you know, if you've been short the stocks, if people would have been reading Asian Century Stocks, they would have known. So I think that's a pretty good endorsement. Let's head over to, you know, let's head over to actually talking about specific, you know, companies and sectors. So let's start at the highest level here. Which sectors are you most bullish on in the Asia Pacific, and why?
I'm very bullish on a recovery from COVID-19, and I mean, that's pretty, you know, that's a worldwide phenomenon. Many countries have been, you know, greatly affected by the pandemic, but in Asia, in many cases, these stocks have not responded yet. Like, they're still very weak. During the summer, from June, July, we've had big Delta outbreaks in many countries here: Indonesia, Philippines, Malaysia. and also Japan had big outbreaks. And the case numbers are now coming down while the vaccination rates are really improving rapidly. So Japan, for example, I think is almost 70% now. It's all mRNA vaccines. And by the year end, they're going to be completely vaccinated, like in terms of the, or something like 85, 90% of the adult population. So that's, I mean, that's basically what I'm doing in terms of positioning. So I believe that these sectors have suffered during COVID-19, like hospitality, tourism, transport, restaurants, and also like entertainment. These will do much, much better, you know, in just a few months from now. So that's pretty much how I'm positioned. I have a good mix of Southeast Asian stocks, anything from Malaysian tobacco company. I have Indonesian alcohol company, which suffered due to restrictions.
Well, let's we'll get into specific companies, but where does the recovery stand right now? Because, you know, I'm in Texas and everything's open. It's basically back to normal. Only place that doesn't seem back to normal, the only two places would be in the back of an Uber or at the airport, where you still have to wear the mask. Other than that, it's totally back to normal. So for listeners who probably aren't even caught up, I mean, I'm not caught up on what specific countries in Southeast Asia, or China, Japan, yeah, you know, where case counts and the lockdowns and all that stuff even stands, because you could tell me that, you know, these tourism industries are still completely shut down and I would have no idea. So where is this stuff?
Sure, absolutely. So Asia is far, you know, lagging behind, very far. And to be honest, you know, you spoke about the fact that I'm European, I'm in Asia for the past 12 years or so. That actually gives me an edge, because I'm looking at what happened back in Sweden, and I'm seeing what happened in the US in terms of restaurants, food traffic, and also like flight traffic, for example. It's recovered very nicely. That's not the case in Asia. So Asia has had complete lockdowns. Borders have been completely shut. Not completely, but almost completely shut. So tourism trade in countries like Thailand, for example, has been terrible. And many small companies have died during these 2 years. And meanwhile, vaccination rates have been pretty low compared to Europe and US. But starting from a few months ago, like exports of vaccines have really taken off. So there are two countries in Asia which have high vaccination rates, and that's Singapore and Japan, so developed Asia. So those are the first to recover in terms of domestically. And then after that, you're going to have all these Southeast Asian countries getting access to mRNA vaccines. But it's just going to take a little bit longer. And then in terms of borders, they're opening up right now. So Bali opened up just a few weeks ago, 14th of October. You know, baby steps, but it's going to happen. Thailand is opening up, started in July in some places, and it's going to open up completely.
When you say open up, are you saying to outside visitors, or are we talking about being like you live there, you're a citizen, and you can just go out and get dinner?
Tourism. So okay. Foreign tourists will be allowed in. It's still very bad in terms of what you have to do. I think you still have to sit in quarantine in both Bali and many of these, Thai resorts. So it's going to happen slowly. It's going to take a while. But Southeast Asia is in a much, much better place than China. And I'm not sure exactly why they're doing this, but they're using homegrown vaccines in China, Sinovac and Sinopharm, and their efficacy versus the Delta variant is a little bit unclear. We don't really know. And meanwhile, they're trying to use this zero tolerance strategy still. So there's no good vaccine. There are no good vaccines, and they're trying to lock down the economy over and over again. So there's no hope of opening up the borders within the next year.
In China,
the guidance. in China. So the guidance we're getting from the government is that the economy, the borders will be locked down for another year in China, whereas the rest of Asia is really opening up. Like the case, you know, the cases are down a lot, and borders are opening up as we speak.
Well, I remember maybe a year ago or so, maybe even further back, there was that video that went viral of the concert or massive pool party, one of the two, in Wuhan, right? And it was kind of jarring because the rest of the world was just completely locked down. So is China internally, are they back to normal internally and they're just not letting people in?
I mean, I think life is fairly normal in China. I think they're wearing masks. But if you look at total retail or consumer spending, I think it's still down versus baseline. It's not the same as before. And right now there's an outbreak in China as well. No one knows how big it is. Like all this data series has been discontinued. So for outside analysts like myself, we don't really know. But apparently 24 provinces have Delta variant outbreaks. And there's now guidance from the government that people need to be prepared for lockdowns. So,
wow,
you know, so China is in a very difficult spot because they've, like in the initial period, lockdowns were maybe good, you know, until the vaccines came. But now they've already benefited from goods exports while the rest of the world was, you know, working from home. Now they're at the end of this kind of boom. The rest of the world is recovering, whereas China is not really vaccinated. So that puts the Chinese economy in a very difficult position. And I think that's going to be negative probably for Chinese bonds and maybe for the currency as well.
So specific COVID-19 recovery stocks that you're interested in, you started listing off, you said a tobacco company and an alcohol company. Let's go through some of these companies.
Sure. Okay. So I mentioned an alcohol company, and this company that I spoke about is an Indonesian subsidiary of Heineken. And Indonesia is a Muslim country. Muslims are not supposed to drink, according to the Quran. But there is consumption of alcohol in Indonesia as well. And it's a big country. If you look at the actual consumption of alcohol in Indonesia, it's extremely low and it's going to remain pretty low. But this is really a recovery play. So the stock is cheap. It's really high quality.
What's the name of the company?
It's called Multi Bintang. And they basically have a 60% market share in the beer market. They're selling their own brand beer called Bintang, and they also sell Heineken branded beer. So it's a very well-managed company. It's managed the same way as Heineken, more or less. It's a subsidiary. And the two issues of course, the bars have been closed in Indonesia. And the second issue is that Bali tourism. The tourism to Indonesia is mostly around Jakarta, the capital, as well as Bali, which is the kind of a resort island. And I think about 25% of revenues comes from Bali. So now when they're opening up again, I expect people tourists to go back and drink beer. So that's pretty much it. I mean, there's a case to be made for much, much higher beer consumption. Per capita, they consume about one-sixth of Malaysia. Malaysia is another Muslim country, pretty close by. So there's good upside, I think. And they also pay out 90% of their earnings in dividends. So I think at the moment it's trading about 10 times earnings, like future earnings or 2019.
Sure. And what's the case for tobacco? Because you can still, you don't need to go to a bar to smoke tobacco.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's actually not the COVID-19 recovery play. That's something very specific to Malaysia.
And which They've company had, is this?
This company is British American Tobacco Malaysia. So that's okay. Also multinational with a local subsidiary. it's a very different bet, but something that I truly believe in. The stock is down about 85%. No debt. It's just down 85%, or something like 80% perhaps now. And it's due to the increase in illegal cigarettes, mostly from Indonesia. So it's a very weird situation. And the market share of illegal cigarettes, it hit 70% at the peak in about 1 year ago. And now it's starting to drop again. So the government is taking, you know, tough action against this illegal cigarettes.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that the play that you assume that the government will crack down on the illegal cigarette market?
They have a new finance minister. They have task force, you know, cracking down on the market. And we're seeing the market share of the legal market really recovering nicely. So, I mean, that's pretty much it. And in terms of recovery plays otherwise, I mean, I have many, but a part of the portfolio that I mentioned is in Japan. And I own a hotel company called Ichigo Hotel REIT. It's a REIT. They own pretty basic hotels. They lease them out via booking.com and so on. The revenue per available room is down about 70%. But we're getting so close to recovery now in Japan. Just a few months from now, it's going to be, you know, close to 90% for the adult population. So I'm hoping that we'll see some kind of effect.
And this one's called H-E-G-O?
It's called Ichigo. Yeah,
Ichigo.
Exactly. It's actually run by an American hedge fund manager living in Tokyo for many years. And he started a company called Ichigo, or rather he got involved in a company called Ichigo. And they are the sponsor of this REIT, which basically owns these hotels. And on a forward-looking basis, they're going to have a dividend yield in the double digits. So that's probably going to, I think the stock probably has 50% upside at least.
I like that.
So that's a recovery. Yeah, that's a recovery play as well.
I'm probably going to end up buying some of these. When you think about specific equities or even the sectors at large, it dominates so much of the conversation in the U.S. Does China always, is that always a factor no matter what, because everything's within their sphere of influence? Like how does that play into, you know, a hotel company in Japan and an alcohol company in Indonesia? Like, do you have to factor that in, or is that completely independent in those scenarios?
I think, you know, there are two major effects, you know, on a forward-looking basis that I think China could have on the region. One is, of course, as an importer, China imports especially like raw materials for its construction industry. Housing construction is excessive, if you ask me, at least. And I think many others would agree as well. But, you know, on an order of perhaps it's twice, they're building twice as many apartments at least as needed. So, you know, that's a potential impact that they could have on the rest of emerging market universe, especially commodity exporters to China. And we haven't seen a deflation of the housing market yet. So that's an impact that China could have, you know, on these countries. And the other one is tourism, which, you know, since 2019, Chinese outbound tourism has dropped to zero. And that's been a key driver of tourism for many of these countries, Thailand, Singapore, Maldives. They benefited hugely. And just, you know, by the virtue of the fact that they have 1.4 billion people in China, Southeast Asia is pretty small. You know, Singapore has 5 million people, 5.7. So they've had a massive influence on the region. And no one really knows right now what's going to happen. Like, do they actually plan to open up after COVID, or, you know, ever? You know, I think the base case is still that they will, but if they don't, it's going to have a major impact on the region. But otherwise, like, in terms of myself, It doesn't really matter too much. I know that most investors pay a lot of attention to China at the moment, but I don't think, unless you're following some kind of index benchmark, I don't think you need to pay too much attention. Like personally, I only invest in Chinese state-owned enterprises, not private companies.
What about the geopolitical risk of them trying to take over Taiwan?
I think you need to take them seriously. Like they are guiding for a communist takeover of the Taiwanese government. That's what they're saying, and essentially Xi Jinping is staking his entire career on that happening.
They're saying that. So they're saying that openly, that we're going to take over Taiwan. We're going to make it a communist country, and. Yep. And Xi Jinping has said this publicly.
Absolutely. I mean, the way they're framing it is that it's a renegade province. It's an illegitimate government, and it should return to the mainland, or it should be unified under the leadership of the Communist Party. And I think this is something that they said for many years, and of course there've been threats. For a long time. I guess it got worse after the DPP took over the government, and I guess in 2016. But it's been said for a long time. The difference now these days is that now they're saying that they don't exclude the possibility of using military means of taking over the island, and that's something new. That kind of language started I think 2020, last year. So there is talk about it, and there's a lot of, I think there's more open aggression, with fighters, with airplanes crossing the median line, for example, between Taiwan and China. So something will probably happen at some point, although exactly when and for what purpose they are so aggressive overseas, I'm not sure. Perhaps it's a way to unify the population, but at the same time, I think it will happen one way or another. Although if I had to guess, it would not be a military operation. It would be more of putting a lot of pressure on the government or cooperating with certain actors within Taiwan to undermine them
inside.
Exactly. I think that's a much, much better method. And they have a very close relationship with the KMT, the National Party, Nationalist Party. Perhaps if KMT wins, the next election, something could happen. I'm not sure. But elsewhere in Asia, notice what happened in Afghanistan. And prior to that, Myanmar had a coup d'etat back in February this year.
Right.
And what was eerie about that situation was that, roughly 3 weeks before that happened, the Tatmadov, the military, met with the foreign minister of Russia, foreign minister of China, just 3 weeks before. And after that happened, after they took over, China has been very reluctant to kind of, they have basically supported the current regime, the current coup. So who knows, whether they played a part in the actual events, but certainly since that happened, they've become a lot more closer to the Myanmar government. And I think also in Afghanistan, the relationship between the Taliban and Chinese is pretty close. So I wouldn't say that necessarily that it's been instigated by China, but certainly this seems to be happening at a much greater frequency than before.
Well, and the country we haven't talked about. Yeah, the country we haven't talked about is Hong Kong. What is going on in Hong Kong? Because all that stuff happened where, they obviously implemented these draconian laws. There were the protests. And again, this is kind of how the American media works, is they come in, they get you all riled up about something, and then they don't come in and tell you how the story ends. So where does that stand right now? How does that play into everything? Because it kind of seems like that was almost, and this is completely uneducated comment here, but that was almost the trial balloon for the real prize, which is Taiwan, right? They wanted to see if the Americans would do anything, and we didn't do anything.
I mean, there are probably some similarities, probably. It's pretty easy for the Chinese to dominate, you know, Hong Kong, obviously. Like, they've had a garrison in Hong Kong for many years now, of course, the PLA. But, I mean, what we've seen happening now is there was a plan for Hong Kong to be integrated into the mainland in 2047 to give Hong Kong a 50-year grace period after the handover in 1997.
Right.
But this promise is basically with the national security law that they introduced just was it last year? That promise is basically over. Hong Kong's legal system has been pretty much undermined in many ways. And the national security law is so vague that you can go after someone on basically no premise. You can use very vague accusations on someone if they criticize the Communist Party, or if they criticize the Hong Kong government, they could basically go to prison for that. So
Jimmy Lai, you know, the big billionaire publisher of the pro democracy, pro freedom newspaper there, is, I'm pretty sure he's still in jail. In April, he was sentenced to 14 months, and I'm pretty sure they just still have him locked up. I mean, it's pretty incredible to me that the US has been completely mum on that.
Yeah, it's, I don't think there's any hope, to be honest. I mean, like, if you support democracy and if you support the status quo, that's not going to happen. Hong Kong will become a part of China very soon, much sooner than expected.
It's it's definitely, you know, it's definitely something that I think, at least, you know, through the lens again of the Western media, there's no clarity at all. It's all speculation. I mean, you were talking about Substack earlier. That is definitely the benefit of getting these insights of people who are on the ground and actually know what they're talking about.
That's right. I mean, to be honest, I'm a little bit less pessimistic about US media. In many cases, I find that Americans, they do understand quite a bit, especially your leadership, or like someone like Matt Pottinger, he really knows what he's talking about. But whereas within China, you don't get the same kind of diversity of voices, at least within China. Outside of China, it's a different thing. But at the same time, as an outsider, I'm sitting here in Singapore. I also don't really know what's in the mind of Xi Jinping. But I do know that we are entering a period that's very different from the opening up period. So Chairman Mao lived until, was 1976. That was a very special period during China's history. Poor productivity, cultural revolution, great leap forward. A period many people, just want to forget about. And since 1978, the reforms opening up process has continued up until 2012, I guess. And now we're facing something very different. A period, in the next at least 15 years of redistribution of income, greater party influence in private companies, that is for sure. And most likely it's gonna be more censorship, more authoritarianism.
Well, you wrote this piece last week, Will China Become Socialist Again? So
that's right.
What was the conclusion and kind of main argument there?
The main argument is that what we've seen, a lot of the events that we've seen so far is really about Xi consolidating his power. And he's going to stay on, most likely. So let's see what happens next year. But most likely he will stay on for life. And he, you know, there is so much evidence that he sees himself as a leader, as a third leader, if you will, on par with Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping. So whatever he thinks is going to have a massive impact on the future of China. And this Common Prosperity Program is not something short term. It is a long term plan that is as significant, I would say, as Deng Xiaoping's opening up reform. And so the question is then, what is this reform? I mean, what does common prosperity actually mean? And it seems to mean basically redistribution of income. So growth targets are gone. They don't care about that as much. They want to redistribute income. And I think a really significant event last year that people really didn't pay attention to, at least I haven't seen anyone talk about it, perhaps Financial Times, was the introduction of these Communist Party committees in private companies in September last year. And these essentially make it such that the Communist Party has the power to fire people if they want to.
In specific private companies.
I mean, in theory, if you read the law, it looks like they will have the power to fire whoever they want in a private company. I mean, that's the way I read it, at least. There are more nuances as well to this to these Communist Party committees. But in either case, I mean, since over the past 12 months, there's been tons of people getting fired. I'm not sure if you noticed that, but the Alibaba CEO quit or resigned. Ant Group, Pinduoduo, the TikTok founder, he quit as well. Just 3 weeks after the government took a stake in the company. So who knows what is really going on? But I think most, if I had to guess, I think that the private sector will see a lot more influence from the government.
So these committees, you're saying there's a committee that oversees private companies, or are you saying that there's different, each private company is getting a committee?
It looks like each company is getting a committee, and these committees have the power to kind of get rid of the CEO, and it's basically sits on top of the board, or it kind of controls the board in a way.
And this, I mean, there's obviously thousands of private companies, probably tens of thousands. So is this for just like the largest public companies, or is this, your local hardware store?
I don't think that we've seen much of this yet. The only thing that I've observed is a large company CEOs quitting, especially the tech companies. That's especially where we've seen these biggest, most dramatic changes. Of course, there've been many such reforms, including these tutoring companies becoming more or less non-profit. But to me, this is if you read this new regulation, you'll be quite shocked. And so there is a focus on state-owned enterprises, and there are many other signals of this as well. In many sectors, such as like real estate, there's consolidation over the past 5 years. Like every year, there's consolidation in the industry. And if you look at Peterson Institute, numbers of borrowing to the private sector versus state-owned sector, back in 2012, 30% of loans were to SOEs. And in 2016, it went up to 80%, over 80%. So the private sector only has less than 20% share of total bank loans, which is a huge change. Like, it's a huge change. 2017, they stopped disclosing those numbers. But I have every reason to believe that the state-owned sector is really getting the majority of bank loans. And if this continues, of course, resource allocation will be greatly affected longer term.
So back to the beginning of the conversation where you can't trust analyst reports, and combine that with what you're saying of how there are no, or basically they're starting to shut down a lot of the public data coming out of the government. How does someone like you get reliable information, or, you know, and how do you determine that information is reliable? Like, what are your sources and then method for actually figuring out, you know, this is coming out of a non-transparent, very opaque environment. How do I trust this? How do I find it?
You just don't play. I'm trying the best I can to understand, understand where things are headed. And I'm obviously trying to find the most intelligent individuals that I can find. So in terms of, you know, Chinese politics, there's one journalist at Nikkei that's really smart. Bill Bishop is really smart. There are a few of these people, you know, you can follow on Twitter or Substack or elsewhere. But essentially, when it comes to China, I just avoid private companies. As a rule, I just don't invest in them. But I do invest in some state-owned companies like CNOOC, for example, the old company. So that's it. I mean, I don't think, China is not Soviet Union, perhaps, but there was no reason, you know, there's no reason to invest in a country with unreliable regulation or rule of law. So in Asia is a big place. You can equally well invest in Korea, Japan, Singapore, Malaysia. So unless you are extremely big in terms of billions of AUM and you have to follow the benchmark, perhaps then you can make certain, you know, you'll be forced to try to figure out what's going on in China. But for me, I'm kind of looking at it from afar, and I'm trying to avoid getting hurt, basically, because what we've seen in the tech sector is frankly like just incredible, if you ask me. Like, it's just insane. These like Alibaba investing in social contribution of 100 billion yuan. I don't know if you saw that news.
No, what is that?
Both Tencent and Alibaba have been compelled to invest 100 billion yuan each. And exactly what those investments are, it's not so clear. It's something to do with social contribution.
Is that the social credit score?
Well, no, I don't think those are related. But certainly they've been compelled by the government to invest these big amounts.
Like, what is social contribution?
I'm not so sure. I'll have to check exactly okay. what those numbers are. Frankly, I guess when I read it, it wasn't so clear either. So I guess you can ask those China analysts what that actually means. But in either case, this follows a number of news stories or speeches by Xi Jinping when he said that companies need to contribute as well, contribute to society. And so, I mean, you can put two and two together. It seems like companies have to follow the party line, and you, as a minority shareholder, you have no power at all.
Right. Now, it's all you know, terrifying and fascinating at the same time. We are pushing up on an hour here, so I wanted to, as a closer here, get into a little bit more about your publication, Asian Century Stocks. You know, one of my favorite essays is the Henry Luce American Century, and so I was curious if that was a play on your name, Asian Century. Is this the 21st century? Is this going to be the Asian Century? Is that why you named it that?
It is. I mean, I think there is a broader, there's a broader shift to Asia, and there are many reasons for that. And I think, you know, we talked a lot about China today, and frankly, you know, they're moving leftwards, turning more towards a socialist governance. But personally, I think that after the current leadership, you're going to get a younger generation and possibly also reforms for the better. That's at least my perception. But there's also, you know, there's a really broad trend. You know, in the next century, I do believe that the incredible work ethic over here and the intelligence of many individuals, it's just hard to ignore. It's not just about China. There are so many countries that have developed, incredibly well, like Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and now Vietnam. So that's one of these things. And it's also, Asia is really the manufacturing center of the world. And that's probably not going to change, although it may change. There may be some reallocation of manufacturing capacity from China, for example, to Vietnam. But I do think that it seems highly unlikely that the situation is going to change over the really long run. So the idea with Asian century stocks is putting the long-term focus on investing. So I wanted to have the mindset when investing that I want to invest in a company that's going to do well, 100 years from today, and perhaps also benefit from these long-term trends. So that was kind of the idea.
That makes sense. Now the other part is the actual, the way that you have this broken down is pretty cool. So you do deep dives, on specific companies, right? And then you have these thematic reports where, you talk about specific themes. So mapping the Indonesian property market, mapping the Asian tobacco industry, you have Q&A portfolio links. And then obviously you just have your general articles that you do. You know, it's kind of an all-encompassing, it's really, I mean, you're one man shop, right?
It's a one man shop. Yeah.
And but you have a full publication here. I mean, it's just, this is just one of these things where if you want to learn about Asia, and I learned a ton on this call today, and I hope that listeners will as well. You don't go to the Wall Street Journal and get the high level once every, few weeks report on what's going on. And we touched on why that is. Some of this stuff is really, you're just not going to find it anywhere else. So I think that listeners should definitely subscribe. That's my honest take. If that you're interested in this stuff, subscribe. You can also find Michael on Twitter at Fritz844. Any other thoughts on how the publication is going and what listeners should know about it?
I guess I should also add that I have a Telegram group, a chat group for subscribers. And I think we're 82 people in there right now, just for people to ask questions, if they have specific questions about stocks that I've covered in the past, or if they have questions about, how they should structure their portfolios. I guess you can see me as kind of a advisor in many ways. I mean, I'm a stock analyst, but this is what I spend my entire time on. So I'm also following, for example, broad trends such as Japanese or Chinese politics. And I think it's always good to have advisors or experts in different areas. And I think Substack is great for that. You can find experts in very specific, narrow interest, areas. So,
well, yeah. I'm trying to build a portfolio here of guests who I can ping when things happen in the world. So I think next time there's big news coming out of Asia, we know who we'll have on. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.